This is Talk of Iowa for Wednesday, January 13th. It's Politics Wednesday on the program, and hosting from Ames, Iowa Public Radio News Director Jonathan Aull. And Jonathan speaks today to Stephen Schmidt, Professor of Politics at Iowa State Political Science, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Lots of topics for today's program. We'll be discussing the governor's condition of the state speech, which was delivered yesterday, the agenda of the Iowa State Legislature for 2010, and a number of national topics, including Sarah Palin going to Fox News as an analyst. Lots to talk about in this hour, so call in or send an email as Talk of Iowa Politics Wednesday begins in 5 minutes following news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, filling in for Greg Shanley. It's Wednesday, and that means it's Politics Day. We have a lot to talk about this week, a lot of state news with the condition of the state address yesterday, the legislature coming into session, a lot of speculation on what they will and will not deal with in the next session that could be as short as 80 days. And on the national scene, several topics, including Sarah Palin's return to the headlines, this time in the terms of becoming a broadcaster for Fox News. We're also interested in your emails and phone calls. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can also call us at 866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. Joining us this week, as most weeks, Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. It's great to see you.
And Arnie Arneson from New Hampshire is on the line, I believe. Good morning, Arnie. Maybe we don't have Arnie. We'll see if we can get that connection. Stephen, you blogged, did a lot of live blogging on the condition of the state address, talking about what you saw for the legislature. You heard the governor's speech. What was your general impression of it?
You know, it was a really good speech in a general sense in a time of incredible challenges to someone like a governor. And I think that the main takeaway that people should have is when they heard the speech, read about it, or maybe saw it, these things are like the State of the Union speeches. Number one, they are marching orders for the legislature. So the governor lays out what he wants them to do. But first, he goes back and reviews what has been happening to kind of set that in perspective. So that's the second thing. The third is to try and craft some policy agendas, and if possible, to be sort of innovative, especially when things are not normal and everything is hunky-dory. When things are dicey, you want to say, I've got some really interesting in new initiatives. And so he tried to throw out a few things there. And, Jonathan, election year, this is an election year, and the governor is going to run for re-election. So number four, it is a political speech. That one of the things the governor wanted to do, which we all agreed on, was to show his leadership ability. And so he tried to do all four of those things in that short speech.
Do you think he succeeded?
I think he succeeded with the majority Democratic constituency. He got some pretty exuberant cheering and clapping from his supporters. I think he may have laid out some things that also appeal to independents and to others who are not necessarily wearing the team colors of Team Culver. I am pretty sure he did not succeed in defusing the criticism that comes from his opposition and also from skeptics, in especially independents who basically are concerned about conditions in the state. So, you know, it was well received on one end. I think there is now such gridlock between the parties that I don't think he probably sold a lot of Republicans on his agenda.
Would it even be possible? I mean, do you think the political this close to an election with one party in the governor's office and controlling both chambers of the legislature, is it even possible for that governor, regardless of party, right, to really cull favor with the opposition party?
The answer, I think, is no, and you're right. But let me try to go one level deeper and try to tell you why I think it is extraordinarily difficult. It's not because there are not any Republicans who would like to work with the governor, who remember bipartisanship. It's because we have a political movement that is there to remind Republicans that if they don't strictly behave themselves and stick to a conservative Republican agenda, they're going to get spanked really hard. And that's this so-called Tea Party movement. It is also the movement to try and get a ban on gay marriage on the agenda, which sometimes those two seem to be the same basic groups. But they have scared the heck, I can't use other words on family radio, out of the Republicans. And they managed to destroy a Republican who wanted to run in New York State for Congress. And she was attacked and basically had to retire from the campaign. They have made life miserable for moderate Republicans. We know about the case of Governor Crist in Florida, where basically a candidate who is strongly backed by the Tea Party and by very conservative Republicans have brought into question whether he's going to make it in the primary for Senate. So Iowa is part of a larger national problem for Republicans, which is they're under scrutiny by groups that are very passionate. And I think the Iowa Republicans in the legislature and those who will be running for re-election, which is many of them, frankly think they have to toe that line. So you're right. It's going to be pretty tough to get any Republicans to vote on your side. It may be that there are a couple of things that they'll feel comfortable voting on. Maybe we can talk about those. But
well, if you're Terry Branstad or Bob Vanderplatz or anyone else seeking the Republican nomination for governor, does anything in the last couple of days change your strategy, give you hope that you have the right strategy?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I think Terry Branstad is sort of viewed as probably ahead of the others. You know, he's been governor. He, you know, was here during those four terms of relative prosperity. We want to forget the parts when the economy in the state wasn't so great, but he managed to attract a lot of independents and would do so in the election. The question is whether he can win the primary now, because he is not very outspoken on the issue of gay marriage. He doesn't want that to be the main issue, and he has been as conservative, anti-gay marriage Republicans and Tea Partiers have said it, he's been silent on it practically. And so that says that Vanderplatz is going to get much more noise and exuberance and money from outside the state and so on for his bid for the Republican nomination. And the other Republicans who, there are a few of them left running, who are more moderate or more perhaps interested in economic issues and so on, I think will fall by the wayside and will end up with a primary between Branstad and Vanderplatz. And there the question now isn't clear anymore whether Terry Branstad can pull it off, because independents don't vote in the Republican primary. And I've said to my very good friend who works for Newt Gingrich and is one of his top staffers, who asked me about this, I said, you know, if independents who would prefer Terry Branstad feel comfortable registering as Republicans and going to vote in the primary, Branstad will win. But that's a difficult thing for people to do. So this is going to be a really, really exciting primary season on the Republican side. I think probably nobody will challenge Culver, although we've had some people saying they will, but I don't think they will. And then we'll have a fantastic race for the governor in the fall, which will be brutal, dirty. We'll have outside money coming in, you know, C-130s full of dollars, and it'll be we'll all be exhausted in November when it's over, because I think it's going to be a very tough race.
Well, let's you've mentioned the same-sex marriage issue a couple of times here, and where we stand right now is that the Supreme Court has ruled
right
that there are two ways that marriage rights to same-sex couples could be revoked, and that is a constitutional convention or a constitutional amendment. And the constitutional amendment would take two—correct me if I'm wrong—two legislatures approving it, and then it going on to the ballot.
Yep. Yep.
It seems that neither of those things are even remotely possible,
right,
especially when you've got leaders like Gronstahl saying,
yep,
not on my watch.
Yep.
I'm not even going to give people the opportunity to what he calls put discrimination on the Constitution.
That's right. That's right. You're right.
So,
right. But this has,
so how does it play out as an issue if nothing's going to really happen on
that? It's a fantastic issue for conservatives and conservative Republicans. They can really essentially use it as an attack tool. They can weave it into their speeches when they're talking about other issues at the State House. They can, you know, galvanize their base. And the chances that it will, in fact, as you said, move in any direction, either, you know, that the legislature will pass a law or that they'll pass the first of two readings for a constitutional amendment is very remote. But it makes for very edgy politics, and it'll be used that way.
We earlier, there's a lot of, we're talking a little bit about the Tea Party movement, and we got an email from Elsie in Cedar Rapids that says, if these extremists insist on using the metaphor, I wish they would take it a bit further. A little tea goes a long way, and when it's properly properly prepared, it can be refreshing. But when too much is used for too long, what you get is not strength but bitterness. When tea is too strong, it can be diluted and sweetened. But when it's bitter, as this movement has become, there isn't much you can do but throw it out, clean the pot, and start over. So Elsie from Cedar Rapids seems to think
cool.
that the Tea Party has a lot of good principles, but that it may have come to an extreme. What's your take on that?
You know, in politics, passion is a big part of what makes people participate, what makes people excited to be part of the process. What you're seeing in the Tea Party in part, Jonathan, is people who are not normally very interested in politics, who have become, let's call it, electrified by several issues. And it is not a political party. It is actually a movement. And you can go Google it. You can look up political science textbooks. We have a nice section in my textbook on the difference between movements and parties. Movements are there to essentially do what they're doing, which is to disrupt town hall meetings, to yell at people, to say we feel passionately about government taking everything over, taxing everything away, and passing laws that don't match our particular views of morality and so on. And that's what they're doing.
If you're from the other, you could also make the case that their job is to take a moral or an ethical or take a very specific position to its unfaltering level and try to influence the debate in that direction.
Yes. And the music tells me we'll talk about this later.
We will. We're going to take a minute break. More of your emails and phone calls after this quick break. You can call us at 866-780-9100. You can also email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Wednesday Politics Day. We're here with Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University. I'm Jonathan Aull filling in for Greg Shanley. We'll be back in a minute. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, filling in for Greg Shanley. It's Wednesday Politics Day, and Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University is here talking politics. We're taking your phone calls and emails as well, 866-780-9100. You can also email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Susan in Ames, who has a comment. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm completely flummoxed because I'm reading that we have in Iowa a little over 13 million less in revenues than last year, and yet we have a solution which is called combined reporting that our legislature doesn't seem to want to deal with. And this is a way to close corporate, multi-state corporate loopholes in our tax system, which would generate a great deal of money. 21 states already do this. And businesses don't leave their states. There are lots of good reasons to have combined reporting. Why do you think we don't?
Stefan, you want to take a crack at that?
We need a tax attorney to call us and tell us why, because they may be able to explain it. I think it is probably mostly related to the fact that Iowa has a reputation, deservedly or not, of not being very friendly to business. And, you know, the taxes are high and all of this. And so I think the legislature and past governors have been reluctant to give yet another indication to companies that, you know, that Iowa is essentially hostile to business, even though someone like yourself would probably say that's not true.
Well, and
you know, that isn't true. And if you listen to Culver's speech yesterday, he spent a good deal of time talking about how business-friendly we are. And in truth, 7 out of 10 of the 20-some states that already have combined reporting find that they are some of the most business-friendly states. So I don't think combined reporting has anything to do with being business-friendly.
In the grander issue here, Stefan, do you think that this kind of regulatory issue, I mean, obviously they're going to dissect tax credits that at some level that's been put out there, you know, other issues like combined reporting or other things that could have an impact on business. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a climate for looking at regulatory issues like that this session?
There is on giveaways. And, you know, we have some of these things that we call incentives and so on. But, you know, they're basically giveaways. You know, a company says, we're going to build a corporate small jet assembly facility somewhere. And we're really seriously looking at Ames, Iowa to do that. We're also looking at some other states that have made us some terrific offers. And then they say, what can you do for us? And we go, well, you know, we'll give you tax abatements and we'll give you all kinds of special infrastructure that we'll build for you and we'll help you put the facility up. And, you know, and then we give companies money to do things like that. And in some cases, as with this particular facility, they never actually assemble a single airplane. And mm-hmm. the facility is sitting next to the Ames Airport and something else is in there now. And there are others as well that have come and gotten a lot of basically freebies and not produced jobs. We saw that. So those, I think, they're just a bad investment. I mean, you know, you don't want to build a facility or help someone build a facility by giving them a ton of money that the private sector itself is reluctant to touch. So we had the rainforest, which was an interesting idea, but the private sector never wanted to put sufficient money in it. They wanted federal money. They wanted state money. They wanted cities and counties to put in money. And so you don't want to do that. And we have a lot of those programs. And those are going to be, I think, seriously revised. On some other things with taxes and so on, I'm not sure that in the middle of a recession and in the middle of the kind of crisis that we're in, you want to discourage business. You do want to raise revenue, but as long as you can find other ways to do it, you probably are going to stay away from that. And I just don't see this legislature going that direction.
Susan, thank you very much for your call. Stefan, if that's true, if there are you know, a series of bad investments that come through these kind of tax credits, do you think there is appetite at the governmental level or at the public level to accept a premise that the way you win the game is by not playing? Because if there's some plant that has 100 good jobs that comes with it and four states are vying for it, if the way you win is by not playing, is there an appetite to do that?
Well, the problem is we've been burned too many times. And I think we're finally discovering that I'll come and I'll tell you I'm going to create 300 jobs and I'll create 60 jobs in the end. And then what do you do? You know, you've given me a ton of money. The ROI on that, on all of the package that the state and the county and the city provided me is more than the return on investment in terms of jobs and therefore in terms of taxes and revenue. That's a losing deal. You know, that's like, you know, you're losing 25 cents on every bale of hay that you're selling. So you go, well, you know, I'm going to sell twice as much hay, you know, to make money. And, you know, that's just not how you do it.
We lose money on every transaction, but we make it up through volume.
That's right. Exactly.
We got another. I want to this call. Dave in Altoona is on the line, and Dave has an interesting comment. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, I was just listening, and the movement statement earlier got me thinking. I wonder if right now what we're experiencing is this movement, this Tea Party and conservatism and prejudice and everything, if it isn't like movements in the past, women's suffrages, prohibition, civil rights, and then in the end, we're going to look back on this time in history, the last decade or so, and say that it was another key pivotal point where society as a whole has been uplifted because of it.
Certainly, you know, this is the interesting point you raise, which is that every movement has been controversial and often rejected. And I think we have to be very careful not to think that history is going in a unilateral direction, that it's going one way. You know, we may have made some policies in the past that ran counter to the values of the country. Now, you know, the discussion is that while most Americans still will not vote for gay marriage if you put it on the ballot, it's lost in all 31 states, that the younger generation is more acceptable to gay marriage and to other social values that older Americans and those who vote more are not comfortable with. And the argument is that's the wave of the future. The second argument actually is this, that it is like a lot of other rights, that it's none of the government's business who I marry, you marry, they marry, and that we don't want the government essentially setting rules, that it is a civil liberties issue and that it has to do with a constitutional right for people to make their own choice. And you know, the interesting thing, of course, is that there is a case coming up through the federal court system in California on the proposition in California that banned gay marriage. And there are two big lawyers, a conservative and a liberal, who are arguing for the fact that that law is unconstitutional. And that thing is going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think eventually it may be that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to take that issue of gay marriage in particular completely out of the hands of states and make a ruling on it. Now, that ruling could be to say, no, you know, states have the right to decide what marriage is, and we'll leave it up to them. It may be that the Supreme Court will say this is really a civil liberties issue, and it has to do with constitutional rights that Americans should have. So I think we're in a period when it's very political, very localized. It's state, in some cases, you know, it's cities that have legalized gay marriage, but that's unconstitutional because cities don't have really the authority to do that. Eventually, I think the whole thing is going to end up out there, you know, in the evil city, and the Supreme Court is going to come up with a ruling on it, and then we'll have to see what that is.
Dave, let me ask you a question. Your premise that some extremism in politics can be a good thing because it does push society in a different direction. Do you think that needs to be tempered, though, by some voice that is actively going for compromise to synthesize the practicality of extremism, regardless of what edge of the spectrum it comes from?
I don't know that necessarily. It's like extremism gets us thinking of things most of us would not think of to begin with. Your speaker mentioned the older people tend to vote against gay marriage, younger people tend to be a little bit more blasé about it. And that's actually my personal experience. I kind of disagree. My father, who's in his late 60s, his attitude, he never really thought about it. His gut instinct would be no. But once you really, with all the discussion about it, you really thought about it, it's like, you know, hey, I personally am against it, but who am I to dictate?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like my wife and our attitude, we're, you know, Catholic on abortion. Mm-hmm. Yes, personally we're against it, but who are we to dictate? So, I mean, I think extremism gets us thinking in things beyond our initial gut instinct to where we really think about them. I'm wondering, over the long term, with as more people get exposed to it, the initial reaction is we're turned off on it. We don't want to even deal with it.
Thanks, Dave. We got to go to break. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more of your calls, comments. We'll also look at some national issues, including Sarah Palin, back in the headlines, this time as a broadcaster. That's coming up after this short break on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, filling in for Greg Shanley. It's our Politics Day on Wednesday. Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University joining us to talk about politics and take your emails and phone calls. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also phone at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. We've been talking about same-sex marriage a fair amount, and Karen from Grettinger is on the line with a comment. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for giving me a voice out there.
You're welcome.
I'm calling to remind the voters and the people listening the governor's stance on gay marriage when gay marriage first came about in Iowa. At the time, he refused to put a stay on gay marriage until it could be voted on by the people. And he claimed he would put it to a vote the next session. And if the governor has changed his mind, and the only acceptable reason in my mind would be circumstances changed, and therefore he changed his stance, nothing has changed to warrant the governor changing his mind. And personally, I don't like any politician who does not stick to his word.
Well, Karen,
you can trust him.
I think we should get some clarification here. And Stefan, legally, what could the governor of Iowa do in this case? What are the governor's options that he can legally do at this point?
Well, I think this is the problem. The problem is once the Iowa Supreme Court rules that something is unconstitutional, I don't know of any attorney, constitutional lawyer, that would say a governor can suspend the ruling of a Supreme Court. I mean, that would totally destroy the value of a court system. So President Obama could say, well, the Supreme Court says this, but I'm going to put a stay on it. I'm going to sign an executive order and say, nope, that's not going to happen. And so I think for the governor, and I think the attorney general has advised him, you can't do that. So he's in a bind, although I think the caller, your point is very well taken, because I think the governor himself has walked sort of a fine line between, you know, same-sex partnership and gay marriage, because in Iowa, the voters are very divided on this issue. And as I said, I think I'm not sure if you put out right now a referendum that it to ban gay marriage, I think it would pass. And so even people who support the right of same-sex marriage politically have been very careful to sort of avoid talking about that. And I think even President Obama has been very careful to talk about it. You've noticed a lot of top politicians have tried to finesse it. So, you know, you also have, on the other hand, groups, one Iowa in particular is a group that I'm familiar with, who are very intent on trying to prevent the legislature from passing a ban on gay marriage and trying to make that constitutional. That would be a challenge to the court. If the legislature passes legislation that prohibits gay marriage, and it's written in such a way that it kind of tries to weave its way through the constitutional finding of the court, which would be very difficult, and the governor then signs that, you'd have a huge confrontation between the Iowa Supreme Court and the legislature. Because Congress, if the Supreme Court passes a law and the Supreme Court says, no, this is unconstitutional, what usually happens is Congress says, okay, how can we make this constitutional? Where do we trim it and fiddle it and spray paint it so it'll slip through and be constitutional? And then it usually passes the smell test.
I wanted to say one more thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Karen.
I wanted to say this. I believe at the time that the governor refused to put a stay on this, I believe he had some political inkling knowledge that this probably would come about the way it has. In other words, the court ruled that it's unconstitutional to prevent them.
Right.
I believe he had some inkling, and I believe he leans that way, and therefore he could put a stay on it at the time.
He could have
play out, but he failed to do that, and that's why I say his stance on gay marriage is the way it is. And even though he now can use the court system to say, okay, I'm not going to do anything because of this, it's his stance.
I think you're right.
Every voter out there to know it, and if you don't agree with that, vote against him.
But I think you are right, because the Democrats generally are in favor of more permissive laws and to allow, you know, people to have more of these sorts of civil liberties, which is strange, because, I mean, it is fundamentally a question of both religion and also of civil law in terms of inheritance rights and adoption rights and rights, to have all kinds of legal authority over each other's assets and even over each other's dead body. So this is a really complicated question. And I think the Democrats, including Governor Culver, in the privacy of talking to family and friends, most of them certainly are in favor of allowing same-sex marriage. But politically, they understand that, sometimes you have to sort of waffle a little bit, and I think that's also true of President Obama. I can't imagine that if he thought it was politically okay to do it without huge consequences, I can't imagine that he wouldn't come out in favor of it. But it is an issue that is dividing this country, the way that abortion is dividing this country, the way that the death penalty has traditionally divided this country. There are some issues where morality, religion, values are involved, where, you know, people have very deep feelings, and I respect the perspectives of different people because they come from different places. And, you know, when we go to other countries and try to get them to basically adopt American values on a lot of their beliefs, we are generally rejected and told that this is unacceptable. And so in the same way, in the United States, there is a large community in the United States of people whose religious values simply cannot accept gay marriage for, you know, scriptural reasons. And if we reject them and demonize them, I think we're missing a point here. And so I want to make sure that we all understand that this is a real difficult political issue. Abortion is a real difficult political issue. And we're lucky that it hasn't erupted into more violence than it already has, because in many countries, these kinds of issues are, you know, easily produce civil wars. I mean, places like India and other places, you get regular massacres of people because they disagree with each other's religious beliefs. And I think, you know, we got to be really careful, because I think we're moving in a direction where we so dislike each other when we have these opposite positions that the threat is always there that we can go over the edge of it. And I hope we won't do that.
Karen, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. One more call on the same-sex marriage issue. Rick in Iowa City is on the line. Rick, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Concerning state rights and the federal Supreme Court, I was wondering, does the Supreme Court have a statute denying states from having someone marrying a 11-year-old girl, say, or a 9-year-old boy? And if that's the case, then if they can have jurisdiction over age limits of marriages, then why shouldn't they be able to declare consenting adults marry regardless of sex?
I think that's a state issue. I don't think there's a federal law on that.
Well, the issue is, your point, though, is what is and isn't a civil liberty in terms of who marries whom? How about, you know, someone marrying three people? The president of South Africa just married his third wife. I saw them dancing at their wedding party. Many Middle Eastern people who have money have multiple wives, and it is both legal and acceptable. It isn't in the United States. What if Utah were to say, you know what, we're tired of being criticized, and there are a lot of Mormons here, and the Mormons really would prefer to have polygamy, and why should we make a judgment that three women and a man shouldn't be legally tied to each other as a household? Why is that something that we can't accept? The answer is it's because it's just not in the moral principles of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And so, you know.
And I think Rick's point is that if the federal government regulates some aspects of marriage, why is this one off limits?
It isn't off limits. It's not off limits. That's why this thing is going to end up in the Supreme Court, and they're going to make a judgment about whether issues like marriage between people of the same gender are a fundamental constitutional right because it is consenting adults.
So
remember,
the
word consenting adult is the key word here. I mean, you know, children basically are a protected class in this country. They don't have the rights of adults, and there are lots of laws that protect them, you know, pornography and so on.
Okay, then
let's
say
so
marrying your first cousin, because I believe that those have – there are different laws in different states on that issue.
Oh, yeah.
So
right.
the federal government could step in on there, and they could step in on same-sex marriage as well.
Well, they could, but
– and then
it becomes
a constitutional
issue. On marrying your first cousin – they would have a real problem on their hands, you know, with Alabama and West Virginia. So that wouldn't work very well. But on the other hand, with this issue, it is going into a federal court as an actual case in a state. It is a case in which government, that is to say the state, has a compelling interest in asking the question, is this or isn't this something that, you know, that in which the Constitution speaks to this. It's the same thing as laws that prohibited, you know, a white guy or a white woman from marrying a black guy or woman. Well, so, you know, the miscegenation was prohibited in many states. And the Supreme Court actually just simply decided, well, this is not a right of the state to prohibit and interfere with people's ability to make decisions like that.
So if you live in Iowa and you are either a supporter of same-sex couples having the right to marriage, or you believe that it should be only between one man and one woman, is it a better bet for you to work on the federal government, lobby at the federal level, try to hope that a lawsuit does get through to the Supreme Court, rather than going after the state government in Iowa to get it to change something?
Yes, and you should also probably find, if you're interested in it, a case to bring against the Iowa Supreme Court ruling if you're against gay marriage, and see if you can make a compelling case that they were wrong in their finding and that there is, in fact, not a compelling state reason to allow gay couples to marry. So, we talked about this during the break. I don't think the Iowa Supreme Court can possibly reverse itself because their finding was on such fundamental constitutional issues of the national constitution, there is a supremacy of the U.S. Constitution over state constitutions on these issues. I don't think if you bring a lawsuit that they will be able to say, oh, we were wrong. Here's a little place where the U.S. Constitution actually says that states do have the right to do these things. So the point is there is actually a federal case coming from California. It is going to, I'm sure, go to the Supreme Court, even though the findings will be in the federal court system of that circuit in California. And so we have a temporary condition when states are going through this. It will end up in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will have a ruling before the end of this year, maybe, hopefully, to put it to rest. And then there will be more politics after that, because the Supreme Court, when it rules on something, it always produces then the response to the Supreme Court ruling. So we have Roe v. Wade. That was not the end of the question of whether abortion or privacy is legal. As I teach in my political science class, when a case like that comes to the court has a finding. It then produces the reaction to that. And what we've seen is a very strong reaction against abortion. And in fact, in many states now, abortion is so hard to get that it might as well be illegal. We also see public opinion changing. The gentleman who called earlier, and we were talking about younger people being in favor of or more tolerant of marriage between people of the same gender. The interesting statistic that Arnie and I have talked on here on the show is that fewer and fewer Americans now approve of abortions, which you would think that younger people, as they become, you know, more and more the dominant population, that abortion would be more supported and approved. And in fact, in public opinion polls, the Pew Center has a very compelling poll, national poll on a huge database. And Americans are less and less comfortable with abortion. That's primarily because of technology, because now they can actually see the fetus at a very early age, and you can see that it's not some unknown entity, but it's a little thing that has fingers and a nose and so on. And it's harder to argue that it is not a human being. So on the gay marriage issue, we have seen a greater amount of Americans understanding that there are many, many gay Americans, and you know, you have the same issue with transgendered people and so on. So,
yeah, and definitely an issue that even if nothing happens on it, it's going to be a big issue this session. Rick, thank you very much for your call. In national news, Stefan, Sarah Palin has a new gig. She's going to be on Fox News as a commentator and will be hosting an occasional show that I believe is called American Stories. Good move politically for Sarah Palin to take on this job?
It is a terrific move commercially. Sarah Palin has a book. It's on the bestseller list, number one, New York Times. I checked it yesterday. It should be in fiction, but it actually is not in the fiction section. She is a speaker whose rates are going up every hour. I understand that her new speaking rates are pretty heavy, and you're going to have to go out and do a lot of bake sales if you want to bring her to talk to your group. she is going to get all the exposure she wants and needs with a network that attracts, you know, a lot of viewers and has done very well. And you know what? It does not prevent you from then quitting your job and saying, I want to run for office. I mean, if you want to run for office, what better thing is there than, regardless of what office it might be, than to be on national news as a commentator, given that platform, selling your book, going around and giving speeches, and then you can quit and run for office and have all that incredible free, not free publicity, but you're being paid to run your commercials. It's like free political commercials for her. So if she really wants to run for president on the Tea Party or maybe as a Republican, this is fantastic for her.
Is it also just having a built-in feedback because she can check her ratings? She can check her ratings state by state. She can see, at least among Fox viewers, to what extent that reflects the population in any area. But she day every time she gets off the air, she could go see whether people were watching or not.
Yeah, and it is it. You know, Sarah Palin is an interesting phenomenon. She's kind of a movement on her own. You know, it's like the Tea Party is a movement, but then you also have Sarah Palin, who is a rogue movement of its own. And my question to you and to Fox and others is going to be, you know, how long is the buzz going to continue? Because, you know, sometimes you burn yourself out. I mean, Jay Leno, you know, he's a great guy, but, you know, he was burned out when he did his new show. I watched it once and I turned it off. It was horrible. He had lost his zing. He wasn't, you know, his jokes were stale. They were the same jokes over and over again. I'm guessing that, you know, asking what the difference is, you know, between a soccer mom and something and its lipstick, you know, you only hear that so many times, and then it's not funny anymore. It becomes annoying. So whether Sarah Palin has staying power, can be fresh, can continue to be exciting and have buzz or not, is questionable to me. So your question is very interesting because it could be that it overexposes her, that it makes that people get so much of her that they're going, oh, I'm sick of Sarah Palin. I can go watch her. You know, isn't there anybody else out there? And so it could have that effect. But none of us know what Sarah Palin wants. I mean, maybe she doesn't want to run for office, in which case this is a nice career and she can accumulate a ton of money and go on and start a charitable foundation or something.
We've got Jay from West Point on the air, on the line. Jay, welcome to the show.
Hi, I just have a couple quick comments. It seems to me like the teabaggers have a lot in common about civil liberties like the ACLU. I wonder if anybody's pointed that out to them. Regarding Sarah Palin, that might increase Fox viewership just so that we can watch her. It's probably a given that she'll quit, given her governor record. And Saturday Night Live writers and David Letterman writers are probably dancing in the aisles right now, seeing that she's going to be on and give them plenty of fodder to write stuff. It's kind of it may be the thing that the rest of the country needs to see, like she's too weird or crazy.
Well, Jay, just in what you're saying and your word choice there, it's pretty clear that you're not a fan of Sarah Palin.
She's entertaining.
I guess that it doesn't matter what Sarah Palin does. She's not going to convert you. I guess what we're trying to figure out is, does this move help her with the people that are on the fence that could get behind her? I mean, Jay and many others are lost causes. They're not going to vote for Sarah Palin regardless. But does this move getting her on Fox, does it help? Does it help with the people who are on the fence who might vote for her, Stefan?
Yes. And the reason is that it gives her legitimacy. I mean, Sarah Palin was sort of discredited. She doesn't know
anything.
Wait a second.
So if someone's on the fence, if they're like, I'm a Republican, but I don't really know if Sarah Palin is right for our party and really represents my views. Oh, she's on Fox News now? Oh, well, sign me up. I mean, is that really happening?
Yeah, it is.
Really?
Because, I mean, if she starts writing op-ed pieces that are published in the New York Times and so on, it just elevates your credibility. And it's the same thing with presidential debates. You know, an incumbent president never wants, or a governor, never wants to debate the challenger. Because as soon as this challenger is on the same podium, then the two become sort of equal because they're on the same platform. And if Sarah Palin is on a network that has, I mean, you may not like Fox, Fox, that's for sure. But, you know, they have some pretty respectable people, people with political careers and people who have been in business and so on. And if she's on the same screen with them, it essentially continues to elevate her to that particular status, unless she makes a lot of screw-ups. I mean, if she gets a lot of things wrong and seems just uninformed, it'll definitely hurt her. I've seen some information that she is actually going to use some of her book revenue to basically get some really brilliant tutor to tutor her, so that the way that the apparently they tried to do with the McCain campaign, to teach her sort of the basics of international affairs, the basics of tax policy, and so on. And if she comes across as smart, and she'll have stuff written for her. I mean, she will have scripted material that can be brilliant, that can be well written, and people might say, "Wow, you know, she's not that dumb. She knows what's going on. She's entertaining." And
you mentioned that we don't know if she's going to run for office.
We don't.
And apparently we have about 30 seconds left.
Yeah.
Is this the new way to test the waters instead of the old way of writing policy papers, writing a book, and going on the lecture circuit?
No, you do that too. You see, you do all of those things. I mean, and she's doing that. You know, you do all of those things. The more you can do, the better.
That's it for Politics Day today on Talk of Iowa. Dr. Stephen Schmidt, thank you very much for being on the show,
well,
as always.
Thank you.
And the program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. I'm Jonathan Aull, filling in for Greg Shanley. Thanks very much. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio.